Good morning. You've been eating your vegetables? Yes, I am wearing a lab coat this morning. And that's part of our Faith and Science series, right? This is the last sermon in that series, the last part of the worship service. And I'm alternately a little bit sad because I've enjoyed the series quite a bit, but I'm also kind of relieved because it's been one of the hardest series to prepare for because I've been reading all of this science stuff. And you'll hear more about that today. La gracia de Dios sea con ustedes, y también contigo. When I went to high school way back in the 70s, I felt like I was in the heyday of scientific discovery. Do you remember the 70s? I mean, spaceflight had already been going on for over a decade, right? People had been on the moon. Quantum physics was entering the textbooks and coming into the science classrooms. Computers were getting smaller. They took up only half the classroom in the lab where we typed out our Fortran cards and learned about do loops. It seemed that robots and flying cars were just around the corner. Fast forward to our time. Sadly, there are too many annoying robots in our lives, right? The little bots that call us on the phone all the time. And still no flying cars. And we find that science has become, for many, a matter of convenience. It's like going to the cafeteria. We love science when it creates all these new gadgets for us, right? But when scientists talk about, for example, global warming, and our role in it, we kind of look the other way. Or worse, we find alternative facts, whatever they are, to support our way of life. And strangely, many of those who ought to be concerned with the truth of climate change, those who sit in church every Sunday, this congregation accepted, seem to be at the head of the opposition. And so one of my side hopes through this series is that what we're doing here maybe just nudges the public conversation back toward some sanity, toward honoring the place of science in conversations about the future of the planet, making the case that science might actually offer ways to complement our faith and even deepen it. Because God does love science. And like the proverbial horse and carriage, faith and science go together. John Polkinghorne, whom I've quoted numerous times, is a living example of the happy union between faith and science. He is a physicist turned Anglican minister. And probably turned is not exactly the right word because he still dabbles in science. But he's written on some of the startling connections between faith and science. So Polkinghorne says, think about light. Take the nature of light. The scientific puzzle about whether light is a wave or a particle, which goes back a little over 100 years, that was resolved by Paul Dirac and some other physicists who came up with the equally puzzling answer that light is both. It's a wave and it's a particle. But here's the key. Stay with me on this now. How we ask the question determines the answer. If we ask a wave-like question, then light looks like a wave. If we ask a particle question, then light appears as a particle. By the way, one of the great things about occupying this wonderful pulpit and preaching with scientists with PhDs in the congregation is that if I muddle up the science, someone will set me straight after the services or in an email, right? And if it's anything serious, I'll be sure and get back to you. So watch the e-notes, okay? Anyway, back to Polkinghorne. He suggests that the way that we now understand light helps us understand how we express our experience of Jesus as both human and divine. I mean, this has been in our tradition for a long time. The early church muddled through it and tried to figure out how Jesus could be human and divine, but Polkinghorne has this beautiful analogy that I wish I'd had in seminary. If you ask a human-like question about Jesus, you get a human-like answer. If you ask a divine-like question about Jesus, you get a divine-like answer. To fully describe Jesus in our experience as Christians, we need both languages. I mean, just like light, the answer is not, it's either this or it's that, take your choice, but it is both. Jesus is fully human. But Jesus is also for us the fullest revelation of God in human life. The answer is both. Theoretical physicists are a fascinating bunch, and someone at the early service who's married to a theoretical physicist broke out in gales of laughter at that point in the sermon. So I think there's more to that story that I need to dig into. But anyway, I find them fascinating from the outside. So, and one of the most engaging of the 20th century was David Bohm, who worked in the area of relativistic quantum field theory. Are you with me? Okay. I am pretty confident that I do not completely understand what David Bohm is talking about, but has that ever stopped me from speaking on a topic before? No. So, as best I can figure, Bohm suggested that the universe was not made up of many different separate things. That's what it looks like to us, right? Rather, the universe, he says, behaves more like one interwoven thing in a perpetual dynamic flux, but we experience it as many different things. Everything, he says, that unfolds in space and time for us was present at the very beginning. Everything. Now, what I hear in this theory is that from the beginning, from way, way back, from the Big Bang, from before the Big Bang, if that even makes sense to talk about before the Big Bang, there is something like a memory that endures, a memory when all things were together. What if all things continue to retain that stubborn memory somewhere deep within us, swans and toads and plankton and javelinas? All of us have this deep memory of being one. So part of what drove Bohm to this theory was what physicists call quantum entanglement. It's the bizarre ways that particles can be in relationship with each other even at extraordinary distances of light years. Things in nature seem to have a desire to be in relationship. So the evolutionary biologist Brian Swim called it the urge to merge. The urge to merge. I mean, think of our solar system, which we have featured in our worship services for the entire series, including, because we're an inclusive church, little Pluto, right? Yeah, yay for Pluto. Think about our solar system. Think about the Earth that has been revolving around the sun for 4.5 billion years. Now that, my friends, is a long-term relationship. Yeah. And we are born out of that relationship. With what? With a desire to be in relationship with others, to be in right relation with all things. I mean, this stuff is in us and through us, like the elementary particles that move through us right now without our even noticing. This persistent memory that we are all one. The writer of Ephesians, did you notice, joins the party. There is what? One body and one spirit, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and creator of all who is above all and through all and in all. Our faith expressing that oneness. Our faith is not about detaching ourselves off into these little communities and separating ourselves into our own groups and walling off others. Our faith is about embracing others. It's about recovering that original unity. In the Quran, there's a description of the creation of human beings. And similar to the stories in Genesis, God draws us forth from the earth. And when the first man and the first woman emerge, God instructs all of the angels to bow down to them in reverence at these new, beautiful creations. And all of the angels do this except one, the greatest angel, Satan. He refuses to bow down. I mean, think about what that means. When we refuse to honor the humanity that we see in another, however different they are, that sacred image that's deep within us, we are out of harmony with God's purposes for us. And we come into touch with what is at the heart of so much conflict and division in the world. Confucius puts it like this: not feeling compassion for a stranger is like not feeling when one's foot has caught on fire. There you go. So how important is it to nurture that primal memory that we are one, all of us, not just the church, all of us, one body, one humanity. John Philip Newell has been writing for years now, and he's been trying to reclaim the ancient Celtic traditions that have practically been lost to us of honoring the sacredness in each other and in everything that has being. Some years back, he was staying at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. He was actually living there. He was in the cloisters. And he got up early on Sunday morning. It was St. Francis feast day that Sunday. And so he went out, and already out on the sidewalk, people are lined up. Hundreds of people are out there on St. Francis Day, right? With, what do you guess, their dogs, their cats, their pets, just waiting to get in for the celebration, for this blessing of all the creatures. I was surprised, by the way, to learn that on St. Francis Day at that cathedral, the cathedral is fuller than it is on Easter or on Christmas. That's not counting all the animals, okay? That's just counting the people. Isn't that interesting? I mean, think about that for a minute, about what that means. So the liturgy that day was magnificent. Paul Winter, who composed the Missa Gaia, was there, the World Mass. And they had somehow brought in wolf and whale sounds were wrapped into the liturgy. And people brought in their birds. And so there were like parakeets and other birds perched on people's shoulders, and in the liturgy of response back and forth, the birds were squawking and making noises. And then at the end of the service, the west doors open, and they have this silent procession of the creatures. And it's silent both to honor the creatures, but also so that they're not startled when they come into the sanctuary. And in they came, this incredible, can you picture it in your mind, this incredible procession of creation. A camel was in the lead that day, and it was kind of straining its neck as if it was looking around at this large crowd of people. And then after the camel, there was a boa constrictor that someone had brought in. And then there was a goat, and there was a pig, and then just everything that you can imagine, the whole gamut of God's creation coming in through this west door into this huge cathedral. Newell said at times he felt like he was on the set of The Lord of the Rings, just watching all these creatures. What surprised him was how deeply moved he was by the presence of creatures inside the cathedral, moved to tears at points. And he noticed that no one had to say during that procession, "This is what we believe." No one had to stand up and recite a creed about creator and creation and all of these things. Everybody already knew, right? I mean, it was that primal memory inscribed in us, reasserting itself. The wisdom that the earth is sacred, that we are dependent on every living thing as they are dependent on us. I mean, this is something that we know deep, deep in our bones. The theologian Thomas Berry says that we are living in a moment of grace right now, that we're living in a moment of grace. We are aware of the oneness of the earth. We're aware of the way things are all so deeply related to each other in ways that we have never known before as human beings. We've never been this aware. And so he asks, what will we do with this moment? What will you and I do in this moment of grace? Will we find ways to move more in harmony with the earth? Will we embody that justice that all of us and that the planet longs for? Will we live in ways that show our deep commitment to the poor? This is a moment of grace, my friends. It's a time when we can translate everything that we know and everything that we see into action. But like every moment of grace, like the flowers of the field, it's fleeting, it's evanescent, it's here and then it's gone. And so what will we do with this moment? Will we meet this moment? Or will it just pass us by? Those are really hard questions, aren't they? And I don't want to leave things there. You know, we need some help, I think, to answer those questions. And so we're going to do something a little impromptu. I feel like to answer the question, I want to hear from the choir again. Are you all up for it? I want to hear from the choir. You know what I wanted to do when they were singing before? Would you mind if they stood and if they felt like clapping? Would it be okay if they clapped? Okay, let's stand and let's hear from our choir because we want to answer yes to those questions. Amen? Breath. That half breath. That half breath. Thing that hath breath.